Blog Talk Radio.
For joining us again this evening. I hope that you'll find the show informative and entertaining, and that it meets your needs. After all, that is the point. I think this has been an exceptional week, and I just want to begin by thanking Dr. Professor Joy Porter for holding us spellbound at Brock University for the fourth Charles E. Sankey lecture. This erudite speaker held us captive. I would say, without fear of contradiction, Dr. Porter was the one of the best, if not the best speaker that we've had to date. She is in a very heavyweight company in that regard. And of course, she was speaking with us about Native American Freemasonry. But I think what captured the imagination completely was when she fielded questions about the essence of Freemasonry. I didn't think all of the questions were necessarily pertinent to the program, but such was the nature of the event. But, you know, for somebody to be asking her questions that would generally put people on the spot, she was more than capable of sharing opinion. And particularly, if you're a familiar visitor to the back rooms here at Masonic Home Companion, you know that the question of the secret of Freemasonry has come up from time to time. And it is the general opinion of the Star Chamber here in the studio that also serves as our family room, that that the greatest secret of Freemasonry is the experience. Yeah, I am pleased to say again that it's best that we don't write down too much, because we have too many loose tongues amongst us. And I think if there's anybody out there that takes offense with that, they need to really simply realize I'm not trying to be offensive, but I think it's more than a reasonable reflection that I've seen is too many things happening in public, openly, almost with giddiness, revealing things that I felt were scandalous, flashing signs and all those types of things that seem to be ignoring the direction and guidance of the ancient charges. But I know you're going to tell me that, Dale, you're barking up the wrong tree. These are fellows that don't know and don't care. I can't say that about our brother, and I don't think that's what you intend. A member of our order is a member of the order and deserves and warrants a certain respect for that alone. But there is an expectation, and Dr. Porter helped us to, I think, to realize that the expectations are quite high. She, you know, she spoke too about the this idea that you and I have addressed over the months about the natural and instinctive nature of Freemasonry. She did that by showing some really interesting parallels by the works of Parker, and the and some did it with graphically with some photo with some photos and that indicated that Native Americans had a key ritual having to do with Good Hunter, the resurrection or the restoration of life to the Good Hunter. Not unlike our notions of the Hiramic legends. You would have already taken those to heart. I didn't feel it was proper for me to talk to her about the nature of necromancy with these different cultures, but by goodness, it was tempting. This fascination with things dead and the resurrection. Does that have anything to do with the Protestant or Christian sense of atonement? Perhaps I'll leave that for you, for the Star Chamber out there to decide. I'm always looking for advice, and as you can imagine, what thrilled me about Dr. Porter's delivery, what not only was it, did it start off very powerfully and then just became transcendent, the room was packed. It was electrified at the end, and for the speaker to have a standing ovation that was well deserved was I think as much a pleasure for everybody in the room to be part of that shared experience as it was for Dr. Porter, who very shyly smiled and blushed and really was quite charming. Although she went on at quite length addressing every speaker that raised a question and doing it as thoroughly as she needed. And the patience that she showed with the throngs asking for her autograph and for her to autograph her, right, in each of the copies of the books. Book sales were just flying of her book. I think today we will have a lot of Masons that have already cracked them open, a lot of the brethren, and will be enormously surprised at the detail. I had a chance to get to meet her over after dinner on Saturday night. And I couldn't help but notice with her that this is such a thorough writer, historian. She doesn't like to say things that aren't factually demonstrated. So her references had references. For people like me and you that like to follow up a thread of an idea, the book is just full of references. And I would suggest we would be well served if a bunch of us, a number of us, took the time to read through them with as much patience as the author obviously demonstrated. Today I'm going to read about this title that came up, An Order of Character in an Age of Personality. I cannot believe that it's been, going on 3 years that with Masonic Home Companion, and I haven't brought this up yet to talk with you. It seems so obvious. So here we go, talking about some of the challenges that I think are facing us each and every day. Can't do that unless I tell you that today, I want you to stay balanced. After all, we are Freemasons, and it doesn't take much to throw us off. We're able to have a good laugh at ourselves while taking everything else in life seriously. I think that's part of the depth of a good man. So any of you that are buttoned down a little tight, get ready to have a good time here this evening with me. Because I want to talk to you about something that I think is really important that we understand. And I need your advice again. Help me sort this out, whether I'm just running in circles and chasing fairies into the forest, or whether there's some merit to this. We come of an era. We come from historians. If you're not a good historian and not a writer, I think you, or not a reader, I think you miss a lot of what Freemasonry has to offer. That said, I sincerely believe that. I don't think we're just set up to socialize and hang out. There are a lot of other social organizations that can provide that. We are that plus. Anybody that would say, try and divide Freemasonry into different kinds of categories, those that come to socialize, those that come for the research, those that come for their spirituality, I think are being a little bit derivative. I think Freemasonry isn't something that's fractured. I think it is a package. We are not expected to be a giggly bunch. We're expected to be sociable, to be well-mannered around one another, at least if you are tend to subscribe to the ancient charges. The more often I hear them read, the more often I'm convinced of another aspect that would be in my best interest to follow. Respect for one another, the manners of a gentleman, the deportment that shows that we actually care. Help me here, gentlemen. Am I just daft? I expect a suit pressed. I expect the dignity of a polished pair of shoes. If a man is coming in from the field at the last second and grabs his apron, I have every courtesy for that fellow. That absolutely makes sense, and I think it does to all of us. And there's a difference between that fellow who comes with an oil-stained hand from working at his labors all day, and that of neglect, of indifference. I think a lodge deserves better. And I think some of you realize we've been taught that there's a dignity. Well, maybe it was Most Worshipful Brother Bradley that helped us with this, but he tried to approximate the kind of dignity that's warranted in a Masonic lodge. As that we would show at a wedding, at a christening, or at a funeral. There's a dignity to the event. It's a cultural event of some importance. And the way we demonstrate that in our culture is the way we dress, the way we act, the way we show respect by the volume of our conversation, and the clarity of what we say. We avoid vulgarity and intemperance. That doesn't mean that we're school children. Being intemperate is different than sitting back and enjoying a class of whatever satisfies your ambitions that evening. I still don't know how we seem to be subjected to the temperance movement, but so be it. I'm not going to rewrite history, but I just think that this is it's interesting. Well, I'll say that. But let's get back to this 85th day of the year. We're heading toward summer solstice, aren't we? And I hope you have your celebrations in the planning stage, whether that's a late night or early morning reverie. Please do something special to mark the occasion. You wouldn't be the first, would you? And hopefully you wouldn't be the last. I think Freemasonry can contain homage to the ancients. There were faiths and religions long well before that predated Protestantism and predated the Roman Catholic Church and the worship and the faith of Muslims, our Muslim brothers, that are also present. The threads are also present. I don't want to get sidetracked into discussions about what we are not, but rightfully, I guess, we serve some of the needs that organized The estates do not. Estates, not states. Estates. Yes. I'm sorry for that. I had to grasp a little bit again. So understanding Freemasonry depends on what a man seeks. It seems to be self-evident, doesn't it? If he wants confirmation of his own thinking, he quite easily will be able to extrapolate all he needs to fulfill his desire. If that's what we're about, I can't imagine that we offer anything to anybody. We're there to stroke somebody's ego. I just think that that is has the vision of a short-sighted man. This, of course, presumes he realizes to go beyond the limits of one's experience is to go back and look at his own thoughts within a broader context of understanding. How do we go back beyond our own experience? Are you and I limited by what we know, what we've experienced in the past? It suggests that our imaginations and our ability to extrapolate is quite not there. Knowing Freemasonry depends on the question for each one of us. How you and I pose the question reveals much about our abilities. And so what question did you come to the order trying to have answered? Oh my goodness, I'm sorry. Did I mention that science, I think, resonates from one side of my brain to the other? So I'm trying to use both hemispheres. Whether pedestrian or esoteric is his question to ask, not ours. In fact, if my studies prove accurate, and I think they are, I've been taught, as many of you have, that the most essential part of research, of undertaking major works of science and arts, is in the nature of the question that's asked. And the rest of the work is answering that question. So the beauty, the strength, is in asking taking the most complicated kinds of problems, breaking them down into their most simple context, the simplest questions. Would it be disingenuous of us to suppose a man can find all he seeks within the scope of his mind? Left with your own thoughts, contemplative. But Bardi defined you and I as men who are introspective. And I find that the ideas seem to flow not out of a large group activity where there's a lot of noise and activity and enthusiasm, but when the mind is still, when the mind is able to reflect and absorb and admit that there's something about what's been read that doesn't make sense and go back until it does. We'll review it from different points. Some of the work, and we're going to get into a bit of that later in the show, we're going to get through Brother Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma in small bites because it is so rich. It is the pâté foie gras of Masonry, to me. Would I have a steady diet of it if you would buy me a nice glass of Merlot? I might be convinced. And we might be good company for one another. You know how conversations tend to flow when we're together? Easy, friendly. But as a steady diet, probably not. Small bits that are easily digested, savored. Would do that with Albert Pike. He is not a man that is easy to ignore. But a real boy, the only kind that I trust. The rest, I think, are just faking it. The pious I don't trust, they scare them jeepers out of me. I'll leave them for the likes of you, I guess. So I'm not supposing. So I ask you, would it be disingenuous for us to suppose a man can find all that he seeks within the scope of his mind? It would be difficult, if not impossible, to compare his potential to that of other men. When we look at him, can we tell what his potential is? We know that it has something to do with diligence, don't we? Restore meritocracy means we have to learn to live with, around people that have merit when we don't. Maybe this is the humility that we seek. Maybe this is the way that we learn humility, the strength and gravitas of being able to recognize people's abilities for what they are. Of course, he was of a contemplative nature. If he was, he would be studious and acquainted with the advances in philosophy, science, and the arts. Maybe he is in small ways. Maybe that's too much of, what do we call it, jingoism? Hard to think of it that way, but more important would be the context of the question he asks. So he may ask an important question or a simple question, but what's the context? When I was writing this and thinking about it, you can see sometimes the ideas flow a little faster than the word processor in me can type. I was thinking about Francis of Assisi. I was thinking about the nature of his contemplation and his potential for understanding. How we look at his readings today and can only be, I think, impressed that he was able to be so human in his understanding of the nature of relationships. I am not sure I would be that generous with our brethren who find security remaining in the cave in their mind. Cave in the mind to stay safe. What is out there and how I define things is only limited, is according to my experience. And since I haven't gotten over the opening of the cave, all that I know is what I see around me. I ask you to refer to Plato again. Plato described this much better than I could. And for those of you who have not yet had the pleasure, I suggest you find a quiet spot and read The Republic, Plato's Republic. Read it to your heart's content. It explains a lot of pearls that you've heard about, and perhaps you would be pleasantly surprised to find that you're reading the source of the ideas. But this idea about the cave, remarkable. Then all of a sudden the man crawls out of the cave and his experience challenges everything that he's known. His mind is broadening, its horizons are more distant than they have before. Does that invalidate the impressionistic sense of the world that he had when he was living with blinkers on? B, I don't know if it exactly invalidates it, but I think that when you step out of the cave of your own mind, the darkness of your own mind, then you open your mind to the potential of enrichment. That, I think, is the purpose of Freemasonry. The rest, the discussion, I think it doesn't matter. Doesn't really matter. If we have 20 meetings a year or 10, if we wear each other out trying to compete, doesn't matter. The point is Freemasonry, the essence of Freemasonry, will always be captured in the minds of a small few. That's how the order continues. It is adaptive where you and I may not be. Freemasonry, the concepts of Freemasonry, have a degree of flexibility. Maybe I like to think of it as the energy at a molecular level. It may morph, it may shift and reform, but the energy doesn't dissipate. Back to our housebound friend, living in an era of celebrity, people of character, I'll include you in that, tend to notice a bittersweet experience each time a such a person falls off his or her perch. The celebrity. I don't mean the mawkishness of the press or the media that make much about the suffering of other people or the embarrassment of other people or their shortcomings. I tend to think there are moments when we need to be able to thoughtfully turn away. There are private moments of disgrace and shame that don't bear witness, whether the community or whether some producer is able to make a cheap profit. The suffering of other people, after all, doesn't impress a thoughtful man. There's things that I don't need to see. Another person succumbing to what? Temptations or distractions or the pressures of the job or trying to meet the expectations of her or his audience. And I don't think there's any area that's escaped this. What tends to, I think, to be disappointing? I'm curious. Maybe it's not that we can necessarily act scandalized about it. We're grown men. I've lived in this world a little too long to be acting, walking around shrieking, acting like I haven't got a clue. Get real. Give me your head a shake. If there's nothing about Freemasonry that's real, what in the hell are we doing? The whole point is to approximate. Are you approximating the truth or are you looking for the truth? Well, there you go. We're imperfect. Yeah, I had a stroke about that. Well, I can't help you with that one. I think that's self-evident. And in that imperfection, we make mistakes constantly. I tend to think that you and I study the history of the order because it's been put together into a fabric or tapestry that contains elements important in the cultivation and development of character. Not so very long ago, that's what we learned, what's important. There were those who were the charlatans and shortchange artists who were still there. Remember the South Seas bubble. Google that or crack open some history books about that. How it nearly bankrupted some countries and bankrupted a lot of people, put their life savings in this scheme to make a quick dollar. And, of course, we know that it collapsed. There was hardships and suffering because of thoughtlessness. Yeah. So what's changed? 2008, we see a world economy, the rakish sneer of these rogue traders that had been taking advantage of good people for generations stopped with the backhand of natural law. Only now we begin to realize that there are a lot of people figuring it out that when those cowboy traders were taking risks and making profit, they weren't sharing that profit. They're amassing it for themselves. That's, I think, a worthwhile definition of greed. And yet when there was a shortfall, these same pundits, faceless often, made sure that risk was conveniently shared by all of us. You know, 21st century, we seem to have figured out the math. And we figured out how mindless that kind of an approach is. Shared risk, not a problem. Somebody taking advantage, not likely to be easy for us to walk away. Not now. You and I are prone to schadenfreude. You know that. Maybe that's a disappointment. Schadenfreude, that sense that we feel a human being feels satisfaction at the suffering or discomfort of another person. I'm glad he fell down. I'm glad he's pained. I'm glad he's inconvenienced. Does that say much about the celebrity that's fallen? Or does it say more about the character of the person experiencing that pleasure? Amazing. Amazing how the lessons of the past can haunt us today. To repeat our mistakes unless we begin to address them. Yes, we live in an age of personality cults and personality and celebrity. I haven't found the instructions that claim that we cannot learn from the development of character that comes from the Renaissance or the Age of Enlightenment or Age of Reason. Maybe even the Reformation, if you're really into it. Looking a little deeper. Regicide didn't really get people too far, but it seemed like at the time there wasn't. The world was ready to pay that price, and British were willing to pay that price. But 11 years later, they had figured out that they needed the monarchy to stabilize. So they put the man's son back. And that continues up until today. Back a couple of years ago when Masonic Home Companion started, I took a book by Montaigne. Remember How to Live Well? I went through it. Went through the lessons. What was Montaigne? 14th century? 15th century? How to be able to live a good life in a battle zone when there was suffering all around. He taught us a great deal. Maybe I'll go pick up some of that material again, just as a reminder. A reminder for all of us, including me. The development of character is possible, but it does require, I think, realizing mistakes when they're made, when they're ours, and taking ownership of them, and being a big enough man to admit it. Yes, I think even Masons are capable of pettiness. So I don't think the order, the value of the order is to erase those elements. I think that's the work of the man, the work of you and the work of me, to deal with our own pettiness. And where do we go from there? You and I have much to learn. Here, I'm going to pick up a paper and read to you a little bit about Stardust. This is from an article, and I hope that made sense. You know, think about it. Living in an age of celebrity, you and I aren't going to change it. Oh, get all grumpy and stiff about it, and that will make a difference. That kind of stuff just makes us look like fools. Oh, excuse me. Old fools. There is I think we deserve, and it is possible to handle ourselves with greater dignity, so that even if we're not sure what's going on, we don't have to make fools of ourselves. That we can be like the, we can rely on perhaps the Epicurean view that, you know, when we're challenged by it seems so easy when somebody says something outlandish to stand up and want to just give it back. The training of a thoughtful man, the training of a Mason. So let the man have a say. Maybe he thoroughly enjoys hearing his own voice. What could give him more pleasure than hearing himself? He's not listening anyway. Because if he did, he wouldn't be carrying on. So give him his 2 minutes of fame. Let him have the audience. Doesn't change the fact that he sounds the way he does and is defining how we think about him. But if he's not listening, okay. But you and I put on our thinking caps here. Wordsworth, you remember the romantic poet Wordsworth? but worth a look. Worth a look. Alexander Brody was my English professor. He taught poetry and prose of that period, Victorian and the Romantic period. And old Englishman had an MA in the, I remember the department heads would look down their nose at him because he hadn't completed his PhD. Of course, he was an English trained professor and quite a beautiful curmudgeon. And over the course of knowing the man, we all became, as you said, you know, we had very little time for us because we didn't know anything, which was the great scheme of things. It was absolutely true. None of us were scholars because we hadn't had the time to read or and pick up a reading list and study and be thoughtful and challenged upon. So he was right. But rather than insult us, he was making a statement of fact. He went out of his way when he was quite ill, soon to die. If he said he was going to do something for us, he was going to have a paper marked and back on a particular day, he would do that. And he would come in looking very weak and tired and give each of us a moment of his time, a bit of advice and a bit of encouragement, and then go to the next, always very patient. And he did it because he said he was going to, and he didn't want to let us down. He was the only person that encouraged us to embrace the sense of being students. It's statements like that that never really left me. He said to us, you know, enjoy the time when you're an undergraduate because you don't really know anything. This is your period to learn and absorb information. And when you graduate, then you go out upon the world and make the difference. But he told us not to be trying to do that while we were still students, but to give ourselves the opportunity and enjoy our ability to challenge ideas and to learn new ideas, to change the way we thought and to grow. And I'm very pleased to say I have always, even to this day, many, many decades later, I remember Alexander Brody. You know, sort of stoop walk and a very fine man. And I know he would love and enjoy each one of you, and I think you would enjoy him. And just an incredible scholar. So here, this is an article by Tim Radford on how life on Earth can be used to tell the story of the cosmos. Ready for a little bit of this? But what I guess I'm trying to work up to our friend Al Pike. We come trailing not Wordsworth's clouds of glory, but clouds of primal hydrogen, the remnants of a galactic nebula, a fabric of cold stardust and droplets of water more than 4 billion years old. We arrive with billions of years of accumulated baggage, you and I, with, for instance, an internal waste disposal system first developed in a jawless fish more than 500 million years ago. You mean my intestine? That's where it started, 500 million years ago. You're going to start to tell me that I'm a product of evolution. What radical being. And a body clock determined by the planet's spin as it orbits the sun. Oh, you mean like circadian rhythms. Well, that was discovered and talked about some time ago. You and I do have internal time clocks. We're better off when you know a little bit about them. They're fascinating. If you don't know anything about it, it's a good opportunity to check it out. Internal time clocks. Determined by the planet's spin as it orbits the sun. Curious? Spring fades into summer, not because that is the natural order of things, but because the same cosmic collision that chipped off the moon and made it our companion also tilted the coalescing planet off its axis of spin by 23.5 degrees, shifting any fixed spot on Earth towards or away from the sun in its annual orbit. We see red and marvel at the rainbow because 40 million years ago, in a suddenly cooler, more demanding world, a genetic mutation delivered in some mammalian ancestors the ability to distinguish colors. And with color, the presence of more nutritious foods and fruits. At every scale, we are creatures of the universe we find ourselves in, the incidental product of a whole series of cosmic accidents that open the way for us to arbitrarily, open the way for us as arbitrarily as it ended the apparently inexorable careers of the troglodytes and the dinosaurs. And the whole story is recorded sometimes enigmatically in our bodies and the landscapes around us. And you might want to pick up a copy of this book. It's The Universe Within, a scientific adventure. It's by a fellow by the name of Neil Shubin, S-H-U-B-I-N. Shubin laid out a focused version of this thesis in 2008 in his splendid book, Your Inner Fish. A paleontologist who discovered the first fossil of Tiktaalik, a preambulating fish, a creature that 375 million years ago dragged itself onto land. Shubin used his find as a marvelous demonstration of the subtleties of evolution through natural selection that preserved and redeployed the fishy inheritance to form skin rather than scales, lungs rather than gills, and hands and feet rather than fins. The universe within is more ambitious. He wants to use the testimony of living things now to tell a story of everything that ever was, starting with the first trillionth of a second of creation, the making of hydrogen, helium, and lithium, the arrival of gravity, the gathering of the galaxies, and the forging of 89 new elements, and the supernova, scattering a fabric that will eventually become stars, planetary systems, oceans, continents, and yes, people. This should surprise no one. We evolved, so we evolved from materials available. Even if we were created, we were fashioned from common clay. Dust we were, and to dust we return. That said, this book of his is daring. Much of the evidence is still debated, and some of it may never be unearthed. Physics has compiled a convincing history of the universe, except for the first second or so. But we cannot explain why the universe is as it is, or even why it happened at all. Biology and paleontology have outlined a convincing chronicle of life's development and colonization, but the opening chapters are obscure, and the beginning a mystery. Well, that got our attention. Well, it would, wouldn't it? You're a Freemason. Primate evolution is an exciting story with missing chapters. But we have no real idea why one species can ask abstract questions, compose poems, and write books about the history of the universe. Oh my, that would be you and me. How did that happen? Broccoli can't do that. But even though the direct connections between the wider cosmos and the details of physiology are sometimes difficult to make, this book offers a fresh way of telling the story of life, the universe and everything. There are delights in every chapter. At the beginning of the 20th century, the exasperated director of the Harvard College Observatory told his staff that he could hire his maid to do their work at half the cost. He liked his threat so much that he actually employed the maid, Wilhelmina Fleming, to examine pictures of the heavens and catalog and codify the stars and nebula. Fleming was joined by other women, and one of the women, Henrietta Leavitt, in 1912, spotted the link between luminosity and periodicity in a class of stars called the Cepheid variables. These became astronomy's first reliable long-range yardstick, with which astronomers could calculate the distances to the farthest stars. These distances turned out to be breathtaking. The same discovery led to the realization a few years later that the Andromeda Nebula wasn't a nebula at all. It was another faraway galaxy. The Milky Way was just one of what would turn out to be billions of galaxies, receding from each other at ever-increasing speed. This is usually the part where my mind just goes, "Whoa, wow." Imagine billions of Milky Ways, billions. No edge, infinity. This is where I get lost, gentlemen. This is where I need your advice. Make it simple. Make it something ridiculously simple so that I can say, "Oh, gee, I'm just silly. I missed my point." Because when I'm sitting there contemplating what they're saying here, it makes me feel very, very small. As Shubin points out, every astronomer is a paleontologist of sorts. The light from a distant star is direct evidence of conditions billions of years in the past. Stargazing has become a way of exploring our own ultimate beginnings. Leavitt was employed at 30 cents an hour. There could hardly have been a richer return. Some of Shubin's most enjoyable stories came from Harvard. Another concerns the zoologist who cheerfully hurled a whole bucketful of live frogs one at a time from a five-story building to see whether they could survive the impact. They did. This experiment, which would not get past any modern ethics committee, is a reminder that size matters in biology. Being small helps us in some ways, and being big in others. It helps explain why species can migrate, can find new niches, can survive or fail to survive cataclysms. There's solid thinking on the revelation of the impact of cataclysm and of continental drift and its role in the precipitation of the ice ages, on the discovery of the strange properties of light, on the exploration of the solar system, and on the odd, almost forgotten adventures of science. One of these was the construction during the Cold War of Camp Century. Couldn't ever talk about the development of human beings without talking about bloody war. So let's talk about Camp Century, part of the Project Iceworm, a nuclear-powered city deep in the glaciers of northern Greenland. Alas, glaciers flow, the tunnels were crushed, and the camp was abandoned. But the excavation delivered the first cores of ancient Greenland ice, and these preserved a subtle record of seasonal, annual, and decadal climate changes first used to trace the history of the story of the past few million years. The universe within may not quite deliver on the promise of its opening pages, but digressions such as these illuminate the story of discovery in unexpected and hugely enjoyable ways. Best of all, they hint at more to discover and more to be told. The adventure is not yet over. Take a look at it. See what you think. Ron Neil Shubin, The Universe Within, A Scientific Adventure. It's published by Alan Lane. And it should go for maybe $35, $40, a hardcover. It's just coming up. And now, the moment that you all been waiting for, we dust off. I can't do that. I have to do this with the lights on. I can't imagine just sitting with a candle reading Albert Pike. You know, that would be just far, far too overwhelming. You have to give me that. But I want to talk to you about, remember when we left off, we were talking about equality. Equality as an organ, remember? Gratuitous and obligatory instruction. Man, would Albert Pike have been an interesting fellow, an interesting member of the order to sit down and enjoy a drink. I can't imagine the conversation. But I would like to think that I could hold my end of it in some small way. he addressed, as we know, we heard Joy Porter talking about him. And, you know, she is thinking, we were talking about, you know, if she wanted to rewrite, she's lovely. She opened her receptive, so I suggested a biography of Albert Pike. Not one of these fabricated types of things that we've, and there's so much bunk about masonry and about masons and history, just scandalous. And people, it's still circulating around. People are, you know, because it's printed, it has to be gospel. This is just tripe. So, you know why I like Albert? Because all of a sudden he became a real boy. Somebody that was flesh and blood. And I think brilliant, brilliant, brilliant man. And as we heard yesterday, he is the only Southern soldier whose statue is in Washington. The only one, the only Confederate soldier. He always dressed as a Confederate soldier his entire life. Very impressive fellow. You see the pictures of him around. So this is some of the writings. This is work from the mind of Albert Pike and other authors of the day. There's a lot of, you would think there's a lot more information about him, but apart from this book, it's a bit, you know, he had a lot of people, a lot of critics. He must have done something to prompt that kind of a reaction from the pious world of around him. A democratic government, he was writing here. We must look at men not so much for what fortune has given to them with her blind old eyes, as for the gifts nature has brought in her lap, and for the use that has been made of them. We profess to be equal in a church and in the lodge. We shall be equal in the sight of God when he judges the earth. We may well sit on the pavement together here in communion and conference, but the few brief moments that constitute life. A democratic government undoubtedly has its defects because it is made and administered by men, and not by the wise gods. It cannot be concise and sharp like the despotic. When its ire is aroused, it develops its latent strength, and the sturdiest rebel trembles. But its habitual domestic rule is tolerant, patient, and indecisive. A democracy, the one so many people are frustrated about because they see abuse of rank. But its habitual domestic rule is tolerant, patient, and indecisive. Men are brought together first to differ and then to agree. Affirmation, negation, discussion, solution, these are the means of obtaining truth. I'll go through that again. Affirmation, negation, discussion, and solution. In other words, we look at things from all sides. These are the means of attaining truth. So much for people proclaiming they know the truth and they're going to grace us with it, and then we all have to find our own way. So much the fool of us, huh? Often the enemy will be at the gates before the babble of the disturbers is drowned in the chorus of consent. In the legislative office, deliberation will often defeat decision. Liberty can play the fool like the tyrants. Refined society requires graded minuteness of regulation, and the steps of all advancing states are more and more to be picked up among the old rubbish and the new materials. The difficulty lies in discovering the right path through the chaos of confusion. The adjustment of mutual rights and wrongs is also more difficult in democracies. We do not see and estimate the relative importance of objects so easily and clearly from the level or the waving land as from the elevation of a lone peak towering above the plain, for each looks through his own mist. Abject dependence on constituents also is too common. It is as miserable a thing as abject dependence on a minister or the favorite of a tyrant. It is rare to find a man who can speak out the simple truth that is in him, honestly, and frankly, without fear, favor, or affection, either to emperor or to people. Moreover, in assemblies of men, faith in each other is almost always wanting. Wow. Hell. Albert seems to have been following me around. He seems to be inside my conscience. It is rare to find a man who can speak out. Moreover, in assemblies of men, does he mean us? You heretical, faith in each other is almost always wanting. Unless a terrible pressure of calamity or danger from without produces cohesion, danger brings us together. Hence, the constructive power of such assemblies is generally deficient. So, he seems to be saying, as we go floating along in our merry way, there's always a need for greater faith in one another. I wonder if he's going to suggest that faith can grow without some kind of calamity. I hope so. Hence, the constructive power of such assemblies is generally deficient. The chief triumphs of modern days in Europe have been in pulling down and obliterating, not in building up. But repeal is not reform. It's almost like he's with us today. Time must bring with him the restorer and the rebuilder. Speech also was grossly abused in republics. And if the use of speech be glorious, its abuse is the most villainous of vices. Rhetoric, Plato says, is the art of ruling the minds of men. But in democracies, it is too common to hide thought in words, to overlay it, to babble nonsense. The gleams and glitter of intellectual soap and water bubbles are mistaken for the rainbow glories of genius. The worthless pyrite is continually mistaken for gold. Even intellect condescends to intellectual jugglery, balancing thoughts as a juggler balances pipes on his chin. In all congresses, we have the inexhaustible flow of babble and factions, clamorous knavery, and discussion. Until the divine power of speech, that privilege of man and great gift of God, is no better than the screech of parrots or the mimicry of monkeys. The mere talker, however fluent, is barren of deeds in the day of trial. There are men voluble as women and as well skilled in fencing with the tongue, prodigies of speech, misers in deeds. Too much talking, like too much thinking, destroys the power of action. Ooh, are we getting to the talks cheap? Let's get on to it. Have at it, boys. In human nature, the thought is only made perfect by deed. So what's the deed? I have faith in you? Only if your ideas and our ideas aren't half-baked. But this is a challenge, then. I don't want to wait for some calamity before faith in one another starts to climb. Can I give that of my own volition? There are men. Too much talking, like too much thinking, destroys the power of action. In human nature, the thought is only made perfect by deed. Silence is the mother of both. Aude, vide, tace. Aude, listen, vide, watch, tace. Silence. The trumpeter is not the bravest of the brave. Steel and not brass wins the day. The great doer of great deeds is mostly low and slovenly of speech. There are some men born and bred to betray. Patriotism is their trade and their capital is speech. But no noble spirit can plead like Paul and be false to itself as Judas. You know, I need to be able to talk with you one day about this notion of atonement. That came from a friend, a really clever a woman named Jill Cameron. She's troubling. She leaves these intellectual bombs on my shoulder. Just, you know, one of those things that makes it just follows you around trying to grasp. She was talking about atonement, this idea. So here we have the symbol of atonement, Judas. Imposture too commonly rules in republics. They seem to be ever in their minority. Their guardians are self-appointed, and the unjust thrive better than the just. The despot, like the night lion roaring, drowns all the clamor of tongues at once. And speech, the birthright of the freeman, becomes the babble of the enslaved. It is quite true that republics only occasionally, and as it were, accidentally, select their wisest, or even the less incapable among the capables, to govern them and legislate for them. If genius armed with learning and knowledge will grasp the reins, the people will reverence it. If it only modestly offers itself for office, it will be smitten on the face, even when in the straits of distress and the agonies of calamity, it is indispensable to the salvation of the state. So no matter how important, unless you offer your face up to get a good smack, take the reins in the by hand, genius, the value of genius will be lost. Are you sure, Al? Put it upon the track with the showy and superficial, the conceited, the ignorant and impudent, the trickster and charlatan, and the result shall not be a moment doubtful. The verdicts of legislatures and the people are like the verdicts of juries, sometimes right by accident. Ooh, it's a little harsh there, Mr. Pike. Offices, it is true, are showered like the rains of heaven upon the just and the unjust. The Roman augurs that used to laugh in each other's faces at the simplicity of the vulgar were also tickled with their own guile. But no augur, A-U-G-U-R, for those following, is needed to lead the people astray. They readily deceive themselves. Let a republic begin as it may. It will not be out of its minority before imbecility will be promoted to high places. And shallow pretense, getting itself puffed into notice, will invade all the sanctuaries. The most unscrupulous partisanship will prevail even in respect to judicial trusts, and the most unjust appointments constantly be made, although every improper promotion not merely confers one undeserved favor, but may make 100 honest cheeks smart with injustice. Time to be strong, boys. Time to support one another if we're going to get it done. The country is stabbed in the front when those who are brought into the stalled seats who should slink into the dim gallery. Every stamp of honor ill-clutched is stolen from the treasury of merit. What a beautiful way of saying it. Every stamp of honor, ill-clutched, is stolen from the treasury of merit. Yet the entrance into the public service and the promotion in it affect both the rights of individuals and those of the nation. Injustice in bestowing or withholding office ought to be so intolerable in democratic communities that the least trace of it should be like the scent of treason. It is not universally true that all citizens of equal character have an equal claim to knock at the door of every public office and demand admittance. When any man presents himself for service, he has a right to aspire to the highest body at once, if he can show his fitness for such a beginning. That he is fitter than the rest who offer themselves for the same post. The entry into it can only justly be made through the door of merit. And whenever anyone aspires to and attains such high posts, especially if by unfair and disreputable and indecent means, and is afterward found to be a signal failure, he should at once be beheaded. He is the worst among the public enemies. I don't think Al like liars, manipulators, and con artists. He seems to be a rather intense fellow. Behead the bugger. Well, maybe perhaps metaphorically, that's what we need to do. I always thought there was some merit when you see somebody vulgar, you know, in an audience, turning their back on the person, not even bothering to look. Get out there at the parade, and when the person passes, turn your back on them. I think that communicates a rather intense statement. When the power for emotion is abused in the grand passages of life, whether by people, legislature, or executive, the unjust decision recoils on the judge at once. That is not only a gross but a willful shortness of sight that cannot discover the deserving. If one will look hard, long, and honestly, he will not fail to discern merit, genius, and qualification. And the eyes and voice of the press and public should condemn and denounce injustice wherever she rears her torrid head. It's giving us a bit of credit. If one will look hard, long, and honestly, he will not fail to discern merit, genius, and qualification. He's probably telling us that we need to be able to look long and honestly so that we can re-examine things that intuitively don't please us. I hope he's not talking about, you know, our clan. We have to go with, you know, culture or race or gender. I hope he's telling us that we can look beyond that. We need to be able to look beyond that. If the woman's the best for the job, then that's who we get. If it's a person that's been through a different history than me, but has deserving and has merit, then that's who we choose. The tools to the workmen. No other principle will save a republic than from destruction, either by civil war or the dry rot. They tend to decay. Do all we can to prevent it, like human bodies. If they try the experiment of governing themselves by their smallest, they slide sideways into the unavoidable abyss with tenfold velocity. And there never has been a republic that has not followed that fatal course. And however palpable and gross the inherent effects of democratic governments and the fatal, and fatal as the results finally and inevitably are, we need only glance at the reigns of Tiberius, Nero, and Caligula, or Heliogabalus and Caracalla, or Domitian and Commodus, to recognize that the difference between freedom and despotism is as wide as that between heaven and hell. Study the Greeks. That's what he's telling us. We'll learn something. The cruelty, baseness, and insanity of tyrants are incredible. Let him who complains of the fickle humors and inconstancy of a free people read Pliny's Character of Domitian. Pliny, P-L-I-N-Y. I think you'll love that. If the great man in a republic cannot win office without descending to low arts and whining beggary, and the judicious use of sneaking lies, let him remain in retirement and use the pen. Tacitus and Juvenal held no office. Let history and satire punish the pretender as they crucify the despot. The revenges of the intellect are terrible and just. The revenges of the intellect. Here's what Will Rogers said about it. If you want to be successful, it's just this simple. Know what you're doing. Love what you're doing and believe in what you're doing. Sort of fits, doesn't it? Let masonry use the pen and the printing press in the free state against the demagogue, in the despotism against the tyrant. History offers examples and encouragement. All history for 4,000 years being filled with violated rights and the sufferings of the people. Each period of history brings with it such protest as is possible to it. Under the Caesars, there were no insurrection, but there was a Juvenal. The arousing of indignation replaces the Gracchi. Under the Caesars, there is the exile of Seni. There is also the author of the Annals. As the Neros reign darkly, they should be pictured so. Work with the graver only would be pale. Into the grooves should be poured a concentrated prose that fights. Despots are an aid to thinkers. Speech enchained in speech terrible. The writer doubles and triples his style when silence is imposed by a master upon the people. There springs from this silence a certain mysterious fullness which filters and freezes into the brass and the thoughts. So he's telling me, despots, these charlatans, these leaders that aren't leading, that there's something happening in the silence, that the writers are at work, that ideas are being developed, very powerful ideas, he's telling us. The demagogue is the precessor of the despot. One springs from the other's loins. He who will basely fawn on those who have office to bestow will betray like Iscariot and prove a miserable and pitiable failure. Let the new Junius lash such men as they deserve and history make them immortal in infamy, since their influences culminate in ruin. The republic that employs and honors the shallow, the superficial, and the base, whose crouch unto the awful of an office promised, at last weeps tears of blood for its fatal error. Of such supreme folly, the sure fruit is damnation. Let the nobility of every great heart, condensed into justice and truth, strike such creatures like a thunderbolt. If you can do no more, you can at least condemn by your vote and ostracize by denunciation. It is true that as the czars are absolute, they have in their power to select the best from the public service. It is true that the beginner of a dynasty generally does so, and that when monarchies are in their prime, pretense and shallowness do not thrive and prosper and get power as they do in republics. All do not gabble in the parliament of a kingdom as in the congress of a democracy. The incapables do not go undetected there all their lives, but dynasties speedily decay and run out. At last they dwindle down into imbecility, and the dull or flippant members of congresses are at least the intellectual peers of the vast majority of kings. Ouch! Ow! Oh! The great man, the Julius Caesar, the Charlemagne, Cromwell, Napoleon, reigns of right. He is the wisest and the strongest. The incapables and the imbeciles succeed and are usurpers, and then fear makes them cruel. After Julius came Caracalla and Galba. After Charlemagne, the lunatic Charles VI. So the Saracenic dynasty dwindled out. The Capets, the Stuarts, the Bourbons, the last of these producing Bumba, the ape of Domitian. Man is by nature cruel like the tigers. The barbarian and the tool of the tyrant and the civilized fanatic enjoy the sufferings of others as the children enjoy the contortions of maimed flies. Absolute power, once in fear for the safety of its tenure, cannot but be cruel. As to ability, dynasties invariably cease to possess after a few lives. They become mere shams, governed by ministers, favorites, or courtesans, like those old Etruscan kings slumbering for long ages in their golden royal robes, dissolving forever at the first breath of a day. Let him who complains of the shortcomings of democracy ask himself if he would prefer a Du Barry or a Pompadour, governing in the name of a Louis XV, a Caligula making his horse a consul, a Domitian, that most savage monster who sometimes drank the blood of relatives, sometimes employing himself with slaughtering the most distinguished citizens before those gates fear and terror kept watch. A tyrant of frightful aspect, pride on his forehead, fire in his eyes, constantly seeking darkness and secrecy, and only emerging from a solitude to make solitude. After all, in a free government, the laws and constitution are above the incapables, the courts correct their legislation, and posterity is the grand inquest that passes judgment on them. That is the exclusion of worth and intellect and knowledge from civil office compared with trials before Jeffreys. Tortures in the dark caverns of the Inquisition, alpha butcheries in the Netherlands, and Eve of St. Bartholomew and the Sicilian Vespers. What did you learn? I don't want to go on anymore. That's rich. That's a little too rich for me. Man. Everything is changing. People are taking their comedy seriously and the politicians as a joke. That was, what was he, a Cherokee? Will Rogers? Diplomacy is the art of saying, nice doggy, until you can find a rock. Don't let yesterday use up too much of today. Seems they had a bit of a mind, as Will Rogers. I think it's brother Will Rogers, no? I bet after seeing us, George Washington would sue us for calling him father. Even if you're on the right track, you get run over if you just sit there. Get up and move. Made me wonder if, you know, as I'm getting older, I'm thinking, you know, I have to make way for people with the energy and vigor. I have an intellectual energy and vigor. I think the mind isn't what I'm talking about. It's that the heart for it. You know, do you have the stride to keep up? I still have a place. Absolutely. Maybe it's because I have some familiarity with the path and can advise. I mean, it's grateful. I'm grateful when a young Mason comes up to me and asks me, what are the difficulties? What are the things I've noticed? I want to talk to you about this. The stuff I noticed. What's your advice? I see people standing up and giving education in a lodge and going into some really esoteric stuff. For me, esoteric stuff is when you're telling me about a number or you're telling me about an apron and the design and the formulation, you know, how it's developed. Now, it's all well, and I want to be so polite, but honestly, I only care when I care. I only care about stuff when it matters, with any context. Or I need the opportunity to be able to ask you a question so that you can answer it with your research. Then it's absolutely fascinating. Then I'm engaged. But when somebody tells me something about what they've been working on, I know they're answering their questions. Surely to goodness, you know, we go back in this work, we want to be able to have the same speakers, our peers recognize that we all have our own question. That's what's important to us. Yes, we have some similarities, and when you look at the big picture, probably a lot of those questions are pretty much the same. But we all like to feel special. Since good judgment comes from experience, and a lot of that comes from bad judgment. We learn from failure, don't we? Or not. Or I tend to think that if we're all of that we're lying about it, if we're trying to convince the world that we've never made any failings, the more you observe, the more you've got to admit that there's some things that are worse than the other things. Do the best you can, but don't take it all too seriously. Everybody has their own different questions. It's like everybody's ignorant, only on different subjects. I love the know-it-alls when you're talking to them and keeping them away out of my hair. Thank you very much. Man. Oh, but as Will Rogers said, all I know is just what I read in the papers, and that's an alibi for my ignorance. So let's be honest with ourselves and not take ourselves too serious and never condemn the other fellow for doing what we are doing every day. Only in a different way. Found an interesting book. This one's by, can I tell you about this? You don't mind? It's called Philosophy in an Age of Science. I thought it had a bit of bearing. Physics, Mathematics, and Skepticism. Well, that's us. It's by a fellow by the name of Hilary Putnam. Now, Hilary was an interesting fellow. So, I'm not going to, of course, you know, hopefully this will tailor some shows in the future, but it's still brand new on my bookshelf. William Putnam's unceasing self-criticism has led to the frequent changes of mind he is famous for, but his thinking is also marked by considerable continuity. The simultaneous interest in science and ethics, unusual in the current climate of contention, has long characterized his thought. In Philosophy in an Age of Science, Putnam collects his papers for publication, his first volume in almost two decades. Mario De Caro and David MacArthur's introduction identifies central themes to help the reader negotiate between Putnam past and Putnam present. His critique of logical positivism, his enduring aspiration to be realist about rational normativity, his anti-essentialism about a range of central philosophical notions, his reconciliation of the scientific worldview and the humanistic tradition, and his movement from reductive scientific naturalism to liberal naturalism. Putnam returns here to some of his first enthusiasms in philosophy, such as logic, mathematics, and quantum mechanics. The reader is given a glimpse, too, of ideas currently in development on the subject of perception. Of course, it's that last part that caught my attention. Putnam's work, contributing to a broad range of philosophical inquiry, has been said to represent a history of recent philosophy in outline. Here it also delineates a possible future. So, I won't get into this at all. It's talking about theorem and interpretation. So I'll digest a bit of that. But if you're inclined, he is from Coggin University, professor emeritus at Harvard University. And the editors are from associate professor in philosophy at Università Rome and the senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Sydney. I think it has some street cred, as the kids would turn to say. Now, if you don't mind, I'm just going to put on a little bit of music and try and refresh. How about a little something Masonic? Would you mind? Something from 1923. Ah, yes. This is Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. I like it. Thank you. let me spare you. 1923, give everybody credit. And he was played with a lot of enthusiasm, and the recording it has the wobbles, doesn't it? But so do some of you. I've seen you walk. So do I. You were building your library of Masonic references. You can see that I don't subscribe to the notion that everything that is convenient or useful for Freemasonry needs to be able to come from our order. I tend to think that a lot of our work did come from and still continues to come from the sciences, and I think it's really important that we understand that the arts and sciences we have no claim to all of these things, no more than anybody else. We're not an order of despotic notion. We have obligations, and we have a task. But anyway, I want to share with you some important information. So let me tinker with the microphone just a little bit to get everything back on track as it should be, and we'll pick it up from there. Clutter, 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 clutter. There we go. The book that I want to share with you today right now is it's called The Builders, a story and study of Freemasonry. And I'm just saying that I don't necessarily adhere to a library just on Masonic materials, but this one is by Joseph Fort Newton, and I hope that you will at least give it a good hearing, because it is it's fascinating. The work itself is written in let me see, when did it first come out? My goodness, this is about, I think, the story and study of Freemasonry. I think 1914, if I'm not mistaken. And this is by, the copy I have is by McCoy Publishing and Masonic Supply House from Richmond, Virginia. And Joseph Fort Newton was a member of the clergy. No, don't let that put you off. He was a good man. So the copy from this is that copy I have is 1914. But my copy, I think, is about 1979. To all my brethren and the gentle craft of Freemasonry, of every race and rite, who have been the inspiration of my research and whose fellowship is a consecration, I inscribe this final edition of my book with love, honor, and gratitude. So there you have it. This is a book that it's divided into prophecy, history, and interpretation. The first part has to do with the hints and foregleams of Freemasonry in the early history, tradition, mythology, and symbolism of the race. The second part is a story of the order of builders through the centuries, from the building of the Temple of Solomon to the organization of the Grand Lodge of England. So, this is a book that it covers by Joseph Fort Newton, covers many areas. The second part is a story of the order of builders through the centuries, from the building of the Temple of Solomon to the organization of the Grand Lodge of England and the spread of the order all over the world. The third part is an exposition of the faith of Masonry, its philosophy, its religious meaning, its genius, and its ministry to the individual and through the individual to society and the state. What happened to the Masonic fraternity from the dark date, 1914 to 1948? The author has added a strange interlude and tells the melancholy story of ravage and ruin in war-torn Europe after two world wars. So I'm hoping that you'll like it. I'm going to try and try a little experiment today. I hope you don't mind. We've just got a few minutes left, but such is the nature of the program, I can experiment. And I try not to cut you off, and we'll try to make sense of all of this. I'm going to put on another base of music for you and see what you make of it. This one, of course. I'll be right back.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little. Every time we say goodbye, I wonder. Why the gods above me, who must be in the know, think so little of me, they allow. When you
time we say goodbye.